My guest Jose Torres is both a former boxing champion and a writer. From 1967 to 69, he held the world light heavyweight title. And from 1983 to 88, he was the chair of the New York State Athletic Commission, which regulates boxing in New York. Throughout his prize-fighting career, Torres was managed by Cus D'Amato, the man he calls the world's greatest boxing professor. D'Amato also trained world heavyweight champ Mike Tyson. It was through D'Amato that Torres first met Tyson back in 1979 when Tyson was 12 and in reform school. Jose Torres has written a new biography of Tyson called Fire and Fear. Some of the exploits Tyson describes in the book are so extreme that they've made the news. He told Torres that the best punch he ever delivered was to Robin Givens, and he described a night when he had sex with 24 women. I asked Torres if he took the story at face value or if he had a responsibility to try to separate fact from macho exaggeration.
He told me the following day when it happened. I happened to see him the day after, and he told me, and I said, yeah, I believe you. Yeah, that's right. And that's it. You know, he was a little mad that I did not believe the story. And that happened months before I began to write the book. So when I began to do the interviews for the book with a tape recorder, then I reminded him of that part. And then this time he was able to call a witness, a Roddy Holloway, who confirmed his story about 24 women. And it is funny because the other day someone asked me if he had reached the climax with the 24, and I said to the guy, I don't know about that, but I'll tell you one thing. His fights, his orgasm lasts longer than his fights, I said to him. In any event, I believe the story. I don't know if there were 24 women though. It could have been 10. You know, Ryan O'Neill was mad. You know, he's a good friend of mine, the actor, Ryan O'Neill.
Oh, yeah, he was in a boxing movie that you consulted for.
That's right. Yeah. He was mad. I said, why? He said, he broke my record. I said, how much was your record? He said, 2. So we're making fun of all that. Now, about hitting Robin, I felt that it was a responsibility of mine to expose that situation, because I am one of the many writers who have been very concerned about the abuse of women in our society. And I felt that the heavyweight champion of the world as a symbol, you know, expressed that malady in our society. And I felt it was my obligation as a professional and objective writer to do that. And I felt that Tyson told me those stories because I felt that he wanted to get them out of his system, and also because I felt he was capable of overcoming those ills.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm interested in hearing about your life as well. I was wondering if you learned to fight before you actually got into the ring.
It's amazing. I was from a middle class family within the subculture of poverty in Puerto Rico, you know, in Ponce.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, we were very, very poor, but my father used to work every single day, 10 hours a day, to support his children. And at that time, when I was about 17, I decided to go into the army. And I went into the army, and as soon as I was there, I knew I had made a mistake. I knew that I could not live far from my family and my mother and father. And I became very depressed. And I was dizzy, like drunk, every day. I was so depressed. And then one day I asked about what can I do to get away from KP, you know, to work in the kitchen,
mm-hmm.
and to stand guard. They told me, well, if you play any sports, you can do that. I said, yeah, I play baseball. So he said, the baseball season is over. I said, well, I play basketball. They said, the basketball season is over. So I said, What is the season now? They said, boxing. I said, I box.
So you boxed in the Army. Then you won the silver medal at the 1956 Olympics in Melbourne.
Right.
Then you moved to New York to train with Cus D'Amato, who was the same trainer who trained Mike Tyson.
That's true. I'm Floyd Patterson.
Right. Now, what makes him so special?
He was special because he was not in the game to make money. He was in the game to help young children. And also because of his unique way in teaching fighters, he felt that what made the difference at the end was not the physical mechanism, but the intelligence and the character of the person. And that alone, I mean, that was so attractive to me because for the first time, I discovered that I was a normal human being when I used to get scared stiff before each fight. He taught me that I was normal. He said, if you did not get scared, I would not want you to fight for me. I want normal human beings because normal human beings can be taught. I said, but if a guy comes to me fearless, I feel this guy's too dumb to learn how to win and become champion of the world.
Mm-hmm. Now, you say in your biography of Mike Tyson that Customato didn't think that sex and boxing were incompatible. He encouraged you to bring your wife to where you were training on weekends, which I guess was pretty unusual for the time. Are the two still considered incompatible?
Well, you know, what happened with Cus was that he knew that there was no medical explanation to justify the suspicion of many athletes who said that sex weakens the legs or weakens your arms and makes you weak. And Cus never believed that. Cus feels that in order for any young boy to become champion of the world, he has to master the fear and master his emotions. He cannot allow any emotion to get the best of him. He felt that since boxers are young, healthy, and in tremendous condition, that the need of sex is a natural thing for them. He feels that by depriving them from sex, they would develop anxiety, and anxiety is an emotion out of control. And he said the only and best way to relieve the boxer from that uncontrolled emotion is to have sex. So he felt that sex then worked on behalf of the fighter.
Mm-hmm. My guest is Jose Torres, and he's the former world light heavyweight champion. He's also the former head of the New York State Athletic Commission, which regulates boxing in New York, and the author of a new biography of Mike Tyson called Fire and Fear. After you won a few middleweight bouts, D'Amato held you back. He didn't give you any significant fights for, I think, about a year. Why was he holding you back like that?
Okay, at the time, Cus D'Amato was engaged in a big fight against the boxing establishment that was being controlled by unscrupulous men at the time, all over the country. And he began to fight them, to buck them. And he used the heavyweight champion of the world, Floyd Patterson, to do that. And he used me. In the process, I was hurt a lot, but I was aware that I was hurt. But I had an interest beyond my own personal one. I felt that Cus convinced me that we together could help boxing in general, and that every young kid coming up today and after me, they would be helped by this struggle against the boxing establishment at the time. So I suffered a lot. I became champion at age 28 instead of at age 22 or 23. And when I was ready then. But the establishment would not give me a chance to fight in retaliation for what Cus was doing to them. And of course, in the final, at the end, Cus had destroyed the boxing establishment. They put like people in jail for that after Cus finished with them. And it was a lot of bad people at the time.
During that period when you weren't fighting, people thought that you had disappeared, maybe because you were a coward. Was that hard to take?
No, because there were only few people who thought so. The boxing community knew what was going on. They knew that Cus was in this fight and that I was backing Cus. And even though we had arguments, there were points in which I told Cus that I was being hurt too bad, that I might never become champion. And Cus says that age doesn't make champions, that old age had not been established in boxing, all that stuff. And I thought that as a matter of principle and integrity and honesty, Cus was right.
Mm-hmm.
And I felt that I had to back him up. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk a little bit about what it's like in the ring. Is learning to take pain part of the art of boxing?
That's automatic. We don't think about pain. The punch that knocks you out, you don't feel the punch. Pain usually you feel it when you are hit in the body, you know, like in the stomach.
Mm-hmm.
Stuff like that. But you train so hard that the pain is beyond recognition. You don't recognize pain. You know, you are so full of determination and will that you don't think about pain. The pain that you suffer in boxing is not physical pain, but mental pain. You know, when you are so afraid of losing, afraid of humiliation, being humiliated, you know, and more than anything else. You know, that's why in the gym nation, you don't care about getting hit. Fighters get hurt much more in gym nations than they do in actual fight. Because, first of all, actual fights are very few. In the gymnasium, you box every single day, you know, training.
Mm-hmm.
And also, there's no pressure of humiliation in the gym. So you don't care about getting hit. You take more chances in the gym,
mm-hmm.
in the fight, because of the public pressure. You are afraid to be humiliated. And, psychologically, it becomes very painful.
Well, you mentioned humiliation. I wonder what it feels like when you're hit hard and your opponent's fans are cheering.
And also, when you... I think that fighters know before it happens when they're going to lose. I think they have a feeling, you know, that the fighters that loses their will to win in the midst of the fight. You know, that's why Muhammad Ali was such a great fighter. Muhammad Ali was one of the few who won fights, perhaps most of his fights, before he went into the ring. He used to discourage his opponent. And the opponent would go into the ring thinking that they were going to lose. And that was a magic that super great champions have, you know.
What's the worst punch you ever took?
The best punch I ever took, it had to be, you know, I was hit very hard maybe four times in my whole career. Very hard. And I was never really hurt, but I was stunned those four times. And usually they happened with fighters who could not punch, you know, who were not recognized as good punchers. And subconsciously, you take more chances with guys that don't punch. So I got hit by them because I took more chances. But punchers never hit me, with exception when I was coming up, of Florentino Fernandez, who knocked me down with one punch. That was the only punch he hit me with. I was not stunned because I was, like, unconscious for about 1 to 2 seconds. You know, I don't remember going to the floor, but I remember when I hit the floor and I turned toward my family, you know, my mother, my father was there and my wife was there, and I looked at them just to tell them that I was okay. And then I got up and I was beating him, and then something happened that I could not throw punches, you know. I was like a delayed reaction eventually, you know, 4 rounds later, and the referee stopped the fight. But I learned a lot that time. But I think that was the best punch I have ever been hit with, because I went down.
Mm-hmm.
But it was no pain, though. And I didn't feel... I describe being stunned with getting a million ants into your body and then coming out. And I didn't feel that in that fight. I felt that 3 times with other fighters, but not with, you know, not the time that I got knocked down.
What was it like being knocked down, hearing the referee's count while struggling to get back on your feet?
Well, I see, I was not struggling because I was okay.
I see, okay.
But I can imagine, though, that it's... Wait a minute. Later on, that happened to me.
It did?
I forgot that part. My last fight, I was hit not with a good punch. I was hit with the bell. You know, the bell and the punch at the same time. And I went down and I got up. And the referee was counting, and I was conscious, but I had no control over my legs. And that's when at that moment, I knew I would never fight again. And I went to the corner, and I came back in the second round, and I knocked the other guy out. And that was it. I never boxed again. But that was humiliating. That was very embarrassing. I didn't want to look at the crowd. I didn't want to look at none of my brothers who were there, or my father. I was so embarrassed to be down. And I felt that no one would ever get that chance again. And that was my last fight.
What year was that?
1969, 20 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
It's amazing.
My guest is Jose Torres. You're also the former head of the New York State Athletic Commission, which regulates boxing. When you were in that position, were there any trends that you saw that especially disturbed you, that you thought were having a bad effect on the sport?
Well, the only thing that I was very careful about was conflict of interest in terms of Tyson. I was too close to Tyson, and I was afraid that my emotions would get the best of me because I didn't care. I used to root for Tyson when he was fighting, but not in New York. In New York, I would be very objective, and also I would put the best officials to work because I knew they would not be influenced by my friendship with Tyson. But going to Atlantic City and Las Vegas and other places where Tyson boxed, I used to go to the dressing room. I used to give him advice, and that was not, you know, completely kosher, as they said here in New York.
Mm-hmm.
It was one thing I want to make sure, and that is that if Tyson boxed in New York, I used to wish that the fight would end by KO, because if Tyson was engaged in a close fight and he got the close fight, I would have been under incredible criticism because of my friendship. So I was always hoping for Tyson to knock the guy out.
Mm-hmm.
So we didn't have to have that conflict. But it was also bureaucracy bothered me. It was fun at the beginning. At the end, it became too bureaucratic, and I quit to write the book, and I'm very happy.
Your new book is a biography of Mike Tyson. Now, I can't think of many boxers who have had second careers as writers. I know that when you started boxing professionally, you were friends with the writers Pete Hamill and Norman Mailer. Were they influential on your early writing and on what you were reading at the time?
Well, not only educated, not influential. I mean, they were the reason for me. I mean, Pete Hamill gave me every single book. I mean, Pete Hamill gave me the first book I ever had in my life. And he gave me the second book and the third book. You know, he gave me like 200 or 300 books. And I was reading all the time. I have never read a book other than a text, you know, book from in school. Never read a novel, never read anything until I met Pete. And that was when I was 20. And Pete got me to read. And then he got me to write. I mean, Pete was the guy, the person who is responsible for me to read and to write, you know. But he was the one. And then, of course, Norman Mailer came later because Pete introduced me to Norman Mailer. And Pete introduced me to Bud Schulberg. And they began to help me, you know. At one point, when I wrote another book called Sting Like a Bee, the biography of Muhammad Ali in 1971. Well, I went to Vermont to live a mile away from Norman Mailer, who I'm sure gave up $2 million just to help me with this book. You know, we exchange. I pay him by teaching him how to box. He was editing my book, you know, and we worked together for 2.5 months. And I finished my book there with him, changed the book around, and he went there for a project that he ignored, and it cost him maybe, I don't know, minimum $2 million, maybe $5 million.
I want to ask you about the inscription in your new biography of Mike Tyson. You write, "To each and every one of my Puerto Rican compatriots who is still struggling to have a free mind and act in accordance with his best judgment, rid yourself of the colonial mentality." What do you mean there, and how does that apply to your experiences?
Okay, I feel that the lack of progress, of significant progress of my people, as a people, because, you know, we have many individuals, but as a people, we're still at the bottom of the totem pole, economically, you know, socially. I think that's due in part to the inculcation of the controllers of Puerto Rico, you know, the American establishment. They reduce our determination to get ahead. We have what I consider a colonial mentality based on subtle inculcation that we are not, you know, in the same level as any other human being. In Puerto Rico, for example, if you go to the market and you see small tomatoes and big tomatoes, usually we call the big tomato an American tomato and the small tomato the Puerto Rican tomato. You know, we see a baby that is born, and he said, how beautiful this baby is. He looks American because he had blue eyes and light skin, stuff like that. So I think that we have to rid ourselves of that mentality, thinking that there are other people who are better than us. Mm-hmm. And some individuals have been able to overcome that, you know, and supersede that. But most of us, we're still in that state of mind, you know.
I have one last question before we have to wrap up.
Okay.
Has your weight changed much since you stopped boxing and since you don't have to maintain yourself in a certain weight category?
You're going to be surprised. And I don't know if this is a... I don't know what, but I developed a little bit of diabetes about 1 year ago when I began having trouble with this book with Mike Tyson and his wife and his mother-in-law. I developed diabetes, and it got a little worse. I would probably have to start taking insulin and taking pills. And I have been under some control, but because I like to eat bread, it goes up a little bit. Anyhow, because of that condition, I lost 15 pounds in the last year and a half, which has been a blessing in disguise. But I mean, the reason is not good, but the fact that I lost 15 pounds, people think that I look as small as I did when I was a fighter, but I'm still 185, 186. And when I used to fight, I used to weigh 174.
Well, I want to thank you so much for talking with us about your life. Thank you.
A pleasure.